now we'll have a moderated discussion with Claire, and then we'll open it up to the audience for some more questions.
Okay, well, firstly, thank you to these three for some really stimulating, great papers. I've got lots of ideas following these, and I hope they've triggered lots of thoughts for you as well. I start by saying that one of the things that occurs to me through listening to these three papers is the way in which political is understood on very different levels through these three examples and discussions. You know, Tom mentioned earlier this kind of manifest or latent idea of politics, but I think one is maybe kind of an identification with a pre-existing political position. Another one would be a denunciation or refusal or negation of a pre-existing political situation. And then, you know, maybe thirdly, the kind of the implication of a new political position through the creation of an alternative approach. You know, and then that, you know, we can go on with sort of many multiple nuances of that as well, whether things get politicized through their context or reception. And I think Irmgard's paper helps to pin down or give a more specific language to those kind of distinctions through this very kind of astute, dense unpicking of different political positions for artistic and intellectual figures in France throughout the 20th century. And so what I wanted to do to maybe bring these three papers together, or just maybe bounce them off against each other, is to think about the idea of authorship that's at stake in each of them. So I wanted to ask both Taro and Emily just to think about what kind of authorship is being presupposed by the Centre for Land Use Interpretation Project, and also by Teriyama's films and theatre practice, in the light of some of the distinctions that Irmgard brought forward. But before we come on to those two, maybe I'm curious to ask Irmgard why you think Godard, you use this metaphor peristaltic, you know, why is he consuming so many different positions? And does that result ultimately in a kind of incoherence, or do you think there's another reason why he's taking, you know, positions which are fundamentally quite incompatible, from Sartre to Breton via Brecht and a number of others that you outlined in this wonderful phrase, revolutionary constellation? So could you start by saying why does he do this?
I think, and I don't want to, you know, go into any kind of attribution of intentionality, but my sense and sort of my strategy for making sense of these works, which, for example, film critics cannot stand, and this is sort of the banned period of Godard's work that critics don't look at, or they are celebrated by Marxist critics, but then militants in, you know, Maoist militants could not stand to see his films. So who is he talking to, you know? And it really became to me to start looking at his films, starting from the question, which for me is the conundrum of May 68, which is who speaks for whom and how? And, you know, everybody, this was this question that everybody was asking, d'où tu parles? Where are you speaking from? And then for Godard, it became a matter, you know, to take this sort of positions in a way, not only to consume, but also to expel, and to just take these positions to a limit, and then so he could be able to move on. And I think that the avant-garde tradition is very heavy in France, especially in filmmaking, when you think that Jean Renoir was making films for the French Communist Party. Mm-hmm. And also another thing was that artists and filmmakers, especially filmmakers, thought of themselves as repeating the paradigms of the Russian avant-garde. Mm. And so, you know, if you think of this repetition of revolutions, the French Revolution and the French Commune in the late 19th century, and then you have the Russian Revolution, and then you have May 68. So a way to make sense of things was to look at history and to try to figure out what was going on by looking at what had happened. Mm. And so the way I see it in Godard is this avowal and disavowal of that avant-garde history, which he relates to as a genealogy. Yeah.
So this consuming of, what you're saying is a consuming of different positions in order to work through the feasibility of any of them in the present moment, and through that maybe to arrive at another position.
Yes, but in a way, they all had failed, in a way, you know. And but what I think that part of Godard's project of these years is to see how far he could take it by not only addressing one by one, but by making this constellation and just seeing what would happen.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So maybe Taro, you know, on this kind of polar opposites of objective denunciation or engaged activism, it seems that Terayama doesn't fit comfortably within either of those positions.
I mean, I was thinking when you were saying the big question was, you know, where are you speaking from? I sort of get the feeling that with Terayama, it's just more about speaking incessantly. And so he's someone who, I don't know, I think that when he makes references, and he makes many, that it's mostly kind of in the mode of parody. And so he will say, you know, I think the very idea that he would change his biography all the time gives some idea of the kind of, you know, how he thought about authorship. And yet he did write all the time, like he published tons of books ranging from like horse racing criticism to like boxing criticism. And he also like penned lyrics to popular songs. So I'm not sure that his project is so concerned with staking out a political position. So like, you know, I showed the image of the Tenjo Sajiki record, which is about kind of queer liberation, but I don't think that was really a cause that he was committed to. And so in Emperor Tomato Ketchup, when the kind of the constitutional laws are laid out for the land, they explicitly say that homosexual acts are legalized, but it's said kind of with other things that are normally thought of as criminal in our society. So it's like stealing is okay, homosexuality is okay, that kind of, you know, so it's this, it's not very clear what his position is really.
So because he's operating through a strategy of inverting the normal rules of society. I know I asked you last night about Mary Louise Pratt because I hadn't encountered her work before on autoethnographic positioning and whether you thought this had a relationship to other strategies of appropriation in contemporary art.
I mean, I think that it does, and just the distinction, as I understand it, is that it's specifically, you know, appropriating in a kind of a colonialist context, so that you're not just appropriating from just a dominant culture, but also the dominant culture that attempts to represent, to speak for you, you know, that, so that you're like specifically borrowing from an image that's already created of you.
Yes, yeah, so it seems that there's a kind of parodic, so if we're going to identify the strategy that Terayama is using in this film, it would be a parodic over-identification with the kind of repressed truth of the American perception of Japan as little infantilized people. And so, Emily, where does... I mean, I think the Center for Land Use interpretations, you know, politics of the deadpan or banality is a very kind of symptomatic indicator of one of the problems that you brought up earlier about what has happened to overt resistance or oppositionality in the present era, and the way in which the political positions have changed or become maybe less legible over the last 35 years. Yeah. So, yes, maybe, but to bring this back to authorship, of course, because that was my original question.
Well, I mean, I think actually this term that Taro just used, or you used, responding to Taro, of the strategy of inversion, sort of, I think that applies to the Center for Land Use Interpretation as well, and not inversion so much, I suppose not a flipping of the things that are considered, you know, that are disdained in society being flipped on their head, but, I mean, as you, the term that you used last night, anti-tourism, and that kind of creating a constellation of this other way of looking, and it's not a revolutionary constellation, but you know, I don't know if that's, I mean, can we say it's something in between, or I mean I don't know, or is that just, does that end up just being inactive?
Because it's a fine line between banality or indifference,
right,
and apoliticality.
Yeah, it's true.
So what do we look to in order to work out what that difference is?
Well, I mean, I guess, I mean, not to sort of cop out of that question, but I think to some degree, time will tell. I mean, you know, I suppose it depends a bit on what kind of response it does enact. I mean, you know, as was raised by the audience, a big part of their activities are these bus tours and, you know, active education. So I think that it's not, I mean, one important thing I think about the Center for Land Use Interpretation is that it's not a one-liner. It's not deadpan in the sense of a one-liner and in the sense of a lot of conceptual art from the 1960s, but they are at the same time delivering important information, and so I think it functions on that level as well.
Yes.
So it has a sort of
because you
function.
Could say, one could also say that the less that is given by way of an overt position by the artist, the more it opens up a space for active interpretation by the viewer.
Right, right, yeah, absolutely. And that was one of the things that I was trying to sort of bring out in looking at the sites that the Loughran Hazardous Waste Facility, where the adjectives danger and warning come from the site. So in a sense, by withdrawing that authorial voice, it allows for a more direct engagement between the navigator, viewer, and the fact that's being exposed.
Yeah. Let's open it up to the audience. There must be some questions.
There's so much lost, and I think in the films that we see that you showed and all of that, once you start interpreting and the websites, all the authors, all the authorships, histories that you talk about, that it doesn't have like a signature. It almost feels like it has a it's homogenous or androgynous, you know, and I feel that with those kind of pieces, it gives room for something else to, like you're saying, like with the tours and things like that. There's more dynamics which can follow it. It's a very good place to be, I think, right now, actually.
Okay. Does anyone want to respond to that, or should we open it for another question? Another question. Brandon.
I have a sort of just a brief historic goal fact question, maybe, for Irmgard, which is about the discussion that you were talking about, the situation of Sartre and Breton, and then underlying and not overtly part of your analysis. But you signaled this at the beginning, is Foucault, and then through Foucault, Deleuze and Guattari, and he's hanging out in the back of these images and things. And there's a distinction between, of course, a universal intellectual, Sartre, specific intellectual that Foucault is talking about. But there's another resonance that I was wondering if you could help me out with, which is Sartre's discussion, and I'm afraid I'm not super knowledgeable about Sartre's sort of rhetoric at this time, but his discussion of non-knowledge, which is for him on the conflicted side of the writer who is producing non-knowledge, which in the way, very much in the way that we were discussing abstraction this morning, is able to be motivated and used by the interests. But then there's another notion of non-knowledge that comes up through Georges Bataille. The notion of non-knowledge, which through that Deleuze and Guattarian and also implicitly Foucauldian discussions of the political gets connected to notions like unpower, impouvoir, which comes out of Artaud and those various things. So there's a notion of an anti-Oedipal, but also a sort of engagement with the minor, is another of these terms that comes through. And so I was just wondering, is there some sort of engagement, maybe on Godard's part, with a revalorization of the non-knowledge? I mean, did he have that aspect in there, or did he? Is that a place where he agreed with Sartre, I guess?
I don't think he would agree with Sartre, and I sort of pinned that down, that in the past 40 years or so, there has been not only an ethnographical turn, but also a pedagogical turn. And it sort of stems pretty much from Althusser's and notion of ideological state apparatuses and how you could counter that. And in that you have in line the whole Marxist filmmaking that is sort of reflexive and so on, but to the purpose to producing artworks and film and literature as science. So during those years, you really have that conflation between artists and science, which I think it's countering not only Sartre's notion of non-knowledge, but also his thinking of artworks as creative enterprises. So you have this productivity, emphasis on productivity, right? And you have that Walter Benjamin was very influential at this period, and he says they're the artists as producers. So they thought of themselves as producing knowledge and science as art. Did I answer? Oh, yes, and in Godard, it sort of materializes in his pedagogy or in his politics of address, where he really, he calls, him and Goran call these the blackboard films, where they really just show you images and submit them to you, and then you make up your own opinion of them in this attempt to try to make the viewer produce meaning with the film as opposed to consume the meaning of what you're seeing. Did I answer your question?
Sure.
Thanks.
Okay, there's a couple of questions at the back.
This is for Emily. Can you talk about a little bit about the Center for Land Use Interpretation in any type of exhibition context? Because I've seen, you know, the last Whitney Biennial, they had just a computer with the link to the site. And I was wondering if you know or if you are aware of any other type of projects in which we could at least find a place for aesthetics, if this is possible to think in relation to their practice, and if there is a place for aesthetics in their practice, or if not, and if this has anything to do with, you know, more activist or more engagement with the viewer or with their, you know, like the passengers of their bus tours. I don't know.
Well, I mean, they have exhibits themselves. I mean, at their centers, they show photographic and textual exhibits of issues of land that describe issues of land use that are of local relevance, and then interestingly when they're exhibited, they're exhibited as an organization, you know, as in the Whitney Biennial. So that, I mean, that's sort of an interesting distinction or difference, I think, in terms of the aesthetics. I mean, I think that they, I mean, are you, do you mean how can we think of them in a visual, in a more of a visual sense? Is that?
Yeah, if there is something that might concern them in a way. I'm not talking about their displays in their own sites, but when I've seen them in exhibitions, I've seen them in art magazines, and I was wondering what is their position in relation to this, you know, to being seen as an artist that is not an individual artist, but that it's an organization.
An
organization that has somehow a different type of practice, because basically they don't produce objects to be seen as a common artist.
Right. Well, I mean, I think, you know, that's more and more there are artists, single or artist collectives. I mean, in a sense, if you're thinking about the Center for Land Use Interpretation in an art or art world context, you know, you would think of it as a collective. And so more and more, I think, non-object results are being produced. So that's a question not only about them. I mean, I think that the reason they're, or part of the reason why they're seen in art form and seen at the Whitney is because they're drawing on, you know, as I mentioned, they're drawing on these artistic and aesthetic traditions.
But through operating as a transdisciplinary research organization, they're also doing something very interesting to the idea of autonomy, which is kind of an auto-positioning of their own discipline, this mm-hmm. anthropogeomorphology, yeah. rather than operating, rather than autonomy understood as a further re-entrenchment right. of medium-specific mm-hmm. abilities or,
yeah.
or skills. It's doing something more complicated in
right.
terms of operating between different disciplines,
yeah.
as you can see by the list of interests and mm-hmm. subcategories that come up on the website.
Yeah, I guess sort of like reconstellating.
Mm. Yeah, sorry, very ill-formulated point, but yeah. There was one more question at the back. Who had their hand up?
I hope it's okay if I open up to the morning too, but and that's given the sort of specter of 68 over this entire project, I mean, that all six papers really did engage, and even Emily is having to do with Smithson. I'm wondering, do you guys see a way to step outside of that? Or is there, I mean, if these, I was struck by the handout, this, you know, 21st century perspectives, which are still very much implicated in a kind of 68 moment itself. And so I was wondering just your own thoughts on how you look at work, even if it's not work of the 60s, without reverting to the theoretical models that come up in the late 60s, early 70s, to understand this connection between art and politics, or if, in fact, we haven't yet sort of figured out a way out of that dead end.
Wow. Tough question. Who wants to take it? You're accusing all panelists of not being 21st century enough, aren't you?
It's meant to be a graduate student question to graduate students, in that I have yet to find a way to step outside of that model in my own stuff. And so I'm wondering, do we just keep circling, or do we pretend that there is a 21st century model?
Well, I mean, personally, I would say a 21st century model comes through the writing of Jacques Rancière, but yeah, it's not my place to chip in on this, really.
Thank you for your question. It is something that I struggle with, and that was one of the reasons why I wanted to go back and look at these films as, again, a sort of genealogy to the global. And I really see this early works by Godard, you know, going abroad and going to see the revolution abroad. It's really similar to this sort of nomadic status of artists just going all over the place. And I really wanted to see what the problems that arose there, you know, at this time, and to be able to to make some sense of what's going on now. So I think that in the late 70s, there was this pre-global, if you want, or geopolitical awareness through militantism, that it's very much, you know, it has mutated, but we're still dealing with the same problems now, you know, which is the question of authorship, the question of mediation, translation, and so on. Yeah, thanks.
Okay, did I see another hand up somewhere?
I don't know what your name is. Rachel, the last question you heard, the best question of the whole panel, personally. And I just think this is so timely and such a perfect way to conclude. I would actually just argue with you a little bit and say that it's not time to get out of these old models, which are not 20th century models, but actually 19th century models. Because of all the heroes we've been speaking about or heard about today, whether it's Foucault, Guattari, Deleuze, Althusser, and so on, they're all looking at who? Marx, Freud, Nietzsche. I mean, these are the great-grandfathers of the people whose generation today is looking at as a kind of answer to our problems. So, thank you.
Right,
okay, one more at the back.
Just a very short thing, because what I'm asking was really good, but yesterday I was sitting at a panel at Columbia, mm-hmm. which was about Geoffrey Hartman and people who are coming from kind of first-generation deconstruction. And it was a very interesting panel, and a lot of people talked about the fact that how, especially Hartman, that, you know, the sense of historicity and the historical consciousness kind of changed a lot. And we are, you know, 68 is a miraculous point, and it's totally, we just start to reread 68, and we just figure that it wasn't what we believed it is, but it was a small bourgeois revolution of bored kids in France. That's a new kind of possibility to say it. But there's a shifting sense of history.
And because history seems to be shifting all the time, you were talking about the end of modernist teleology. 68 and the continuous rereading of 68 made us very much aware that there is absolutely impossible to look into history or into modernism as a teleology. And 68 is the moment which made us aware of that. So I don't think so that it's possible to step out of 68 because it would be to find a new form of historical consciousness. And you just don't find that sort of historical consciousness. You do your job and suddenly things start to emerge. Until then, you deal with the floating signifiers and the rereading of history. So just, it's not me, Geoffrey Hartman.
Okay, thank you.
Can I just make, there's a recent news in France a year or two ago of some minority students who were chased into a electric house. I don't know if you guys remember, and they're electric, they're chased by the police. And it started, almost started a revolution, but it was labeled as a racial problem in France. So there's awareness of these kind of things that go on.
Okay, thank you.
We're going to shift to outside. Thank you very much for your participation today, and thank you for joining us, and thank you.